That moment, that sentence, ended the jinx and left me stunned. Durst was arrested the day before the finale was televised, and the show has made news since. My point is, we should be talking about great television as it happens. And the only efficient way to do that is if it happens to enough of us at the same time on schedule.
David Bianculli is founder and editor of the website TV Worth Watching and teaches TV and film history at Rowan University in New Jersey. Tomorrow, I'll talk with Daniel Jenness, who grew up around Soviet emigres who risked prison for a cause. Daniel Jenness was sent to prison because he robbed people to get enough money to pay what he owed his heroin dealer. He was released after 10 years and is now writing a memoir about the 1,046 books he read in prison. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving with brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program. Performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com. And from Angie's List, providing reviews on local companies to help consumers buy services and achieve their home improvement goals of remodeled kitchens, freshly painted houses, or new backyards. More at AngiesList.com.
In New York, some public housing residents see police as harassing, not helping their communities.
I don't feel safe around the police.
They want to go back to the days of housing police, when more officers knew and sometimes lived in the places they policed.
They know who's a troublemaker and who's not.
That's today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Tonight on 360 North at 8, what's vital for survival in the unforgiving Arctic? Inuit sports evolve to strengthen mind, body, and spirit within the community. Games of the North follows athletes and reveals the game's importance today. Native Report is at 8:30. At 9, a hidden epidemic shines a light on critical questions about substance abuse among the elderly. Gavel Alaska returns at 10. Tonight on 360 North and 360north.org.
Welcome to a Juno Afternoon on Tuesday, March 17th, 2015. I'm your host, Scott Burton. On today's show, we'll talk with Sasha Sobolov about gold medal basketball. Tim Ortiz will be here with details about his upcoming watercolor painting class at the Canvas. We'll talk to the Alaskan Brewing Company's Andy Klein about their new seasonal beer. And we'll learn about the charter school open house and application process for the next school year. Those interviews, National Native News Writers Almanac, Bird Note Music, and more right here on a Juno Afternoon.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Alaska's Governor Bill Walker Monday asked for a 30-day extension to consider issues in a case tribes say will determine how the Indian Child Welfare Act is carried out in the state. KNBA's Jacqueline Estes has more.
Under ICWA, Native Americans have preference in adopting Native children, but a 2014 Alaska Supreme Court ruling allowed a non-Native couple to adopt a Yupik child because her grandmother Elise of Tununuk hadn't filed a petition to adopt. Elise's attorney, Lloyd Miller, who specializes in Native American law, says the grandmother met all such requirements with her repeated statements to officials and court testimony that she wanted to adopt her granddaughter. Miller says the Walker administration is right to take the time to look at the larger implications of Tununuk versus Alaska.
This case is a potentially explosive case and could well define the administration's position in Alaska Native affairs, and in particular, the relationship the administration is going to have with tribes in Alaska.
Alaska Assistant Attorney General Jacqueline Schaefer says the state is looking for ways to work with tribes to ease adoption requirements and to improve children's services to Alaska Native communities. The state's request for an extension comes after the Alaska Federation of Natives and all the Native regional nonprofit organizations in Alaska asked the state to change its position. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
Meanwhile, Alaska Governor Bill Walker Monday met with representatives from 42 communities in interior Alaska. Walker, who's been in office for more than 90 days, says one of his main goals is tribal relations. He says he wants to go beyond consultation by having tribes help in decision-making. Walker says he's inherited litigation and is catching up to take time before making any decisions. He also touched on subsistence and health care. Walker says the state is making an aggressive push with a bill coming out this week on Medicaid expansion. He says there's only 40 days left in the legislative session. Walker made the comments before the Tanana Chiefs Conference annual convention taking place this week in Fairbanks. Members of the Rosebud Sioux Tribal Council in South Dakota held an informal meeting on dog attacks just hours before a fatal incident on a woman Saturday. Jim Kent has more.
Rosebud Sioux Tribal Council Representative Wayne Frederick says it's tragically ironic that Julia Charging Whirlwind's death was almost prevented.
There's actually a private individual in St. Francis. She actually started this dog kennel. She said that if the tribe would approve a contract with her, or at least to approve her services so that tribal monies could be spent on her services, then we could employ her to go up and investigate this dog pack.
Derek Claremont has lived on the Rosebud Reservation all his life and says dog attacks are not the norm. He agrees that this incident could have been avoided, but from another perspective.
The day before, my sister had called the Rosebud Sioux Tribe Police Department because these same dogs had almost got my little nephew. We called them and they haven't showed up. They never showed up.
Claremont says he hates to point a finger at the tribal police, but that's where he feels the blame lies. Meanwhile, Tribal Council Representative Frederick says tribal police did respond to a call 4 days prior to the fatal attack, but couldn't find the dogs in question.
They went door to door today and they actually rounded up a bunch of dogs and they actually disposed of what they believed were the problematic dogs.
For his part, Derek Claremont says the problem isn't the dogs, it's the people who own them and don't know how to care for or train them. For National Native News, I'm Jim Kent.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Support by the Association of American Indian Physicians. Colon cancer is the second leading cause of cancer death in American Indians 50 and over. For yourself, your family, and our community, get screened. Info at AmericanIndianCancer.org.
When you file online for your PFD, every Alaskan can support National Native News. Just use Pick, Click, Give, and select KNBA-FM Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation. With one donation at a time, good things will happen all over Alaska.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Service.
Dear Mom, thank you for quitting smoking. It's hard to do, but smoking can kill you, so quitting saved your life. I'm so lucky to have parents like you and Dad. Other parents would probably say, oh, he's just a kid. Love, Nick.
My kids inspired me to quit.
Find your reason to quit smoking.
Call Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line, free for all Alaskans, at 1-800-QUIT-NOW.
This message is brought to you by Search, your partner in health.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Tuesday, March 17th, 2015. It's about 6.5 minutes after the hour, and I've been joined in the studio by Tim Ortiz. He's a painter who's teaching at the Canvas. Welcome, Tim.
Hi, thank you.
Yeah. So you have a watercolor painting class coming up that I definitely want to talk about, but it's a really interesting project that you're on here in Juneau. Why don't you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, I'm in Juneau right now because of my project, DisparateMinds.org, which my partner and I, Andriana, have been working on over the past year or so. It's a blog about art studios, progressive art studios that support artists with developmental disabilities. So the Canvas, obviously, it reaches one of those, one of the 20 or so that we visited in the course of the project. And so we've come up here for this year to do some teaching at the Canvas for the artists they serve and also for the local community.
Okay. How many have you had a chance to visit so far?
We visited a total of 25 studios all across the country.
Wow. And what is the state of progressive studios across the country like?
It's very good right now. It's in transition, and it seems to be having a lot of success, especially recently. These studios have been around since the 70s. The oldest ones started in the 70s, the late 70s, in San Francisco, and one in Boston is the oldest one. And they've been becoming more numerous since then, especially the past 10 years or so. And the art that they make has been gaining more and more respect and more of a presence in the contemporary art world, which is really exciting for us. And we feel like that's really important for art and for these communities, and so that's why we've been pursuing that.
Yeah, and thinking of all the studios that you visited across the country, what have been some of the models, the successful models, some traits of those successful models that you've seen?
Well, the most successful models tend to be. They're very different. There's different studios do very different things, but allowing for a lot of autonomy for the artists is crucial, and allowing the artists to create without direction, as far as sort of didactic teaching. What makes these programs successful is that these artists are able to, if they're allowed, find a voice in art making that they haven't had any other way. And so if they're permitted to be creative, if they're encouraged, they're facilitated, given materials that they need and validated for the choices they make, their work becomes very sophisticated over time, and they really learn to embrace it. So the models that do that best are the ones that offer an open studio, offer a lot of freedom for creative exploration.
And not to put you on the spot, but may I ask how the Canvas is doing?
The Canvas is doing fantastic. We came up to the Canvas because they offer this year-long teaching opportunity to allow different artists to come in and work with their artists, which is a great concept, great idea. And also because one of the things that the Canvas does that's unique is that they really strive to be integrated and to connect with the community in Juneau, especially by offering art classes to the community as well as the population that they serve. And we feel like that's really important, and finding ways to do that is something a lot of different studios are trying to do. And in fact, some around the country have learned from the Canvas in that regard and are starting to do that sort of thing as well.
Okay. And at the same time, you're painting as you travel. Tell us a little bit about the work that you produce.
I'm a painter. I'm primarily an abstract painter, but my background, my foundation is in landscape and still life painting in a very traditional sense. And so I fell in love with art that way, and I still regard myself a painter. I still do quite a bit of work from life. That's really important to me. And I will be having some teaching on abstraction coming up in the future, but the one I'm teaching right now is more traditional.
Okay, and can you give us the details of this class?
Yeah, this class is a painting class in watercolor. It's starting this Thursday, the 19th. And it's going to be focused on still life. So what we're going to be doing is something that's accessible for anybody. You don't have to be an expert or experienced artist or painter or watercolor painter to get into this. It's a basic introduction to watercolor painting and also an introduction to making still lives and to exploring the concept of still life.
And like you said, it sounds like anybody can take this class, beginners included.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I definitely want to be as accessible as possible. So we're going to be spending, it's a four-week class. The first couple of weeks will be just all about technique. We're going to be dealing with watercolor paints, watercolor papers, setting up the palette, basic ideas like this. And then the second half of the class, the last 2 weeks, will be focused more on concept and still life, because I feel like it's very important to explore both things. Exploring the concept of still life will help to inform the application and handling of watercolor, so we'll be getting into both sides of it.
And can you give us one highlight of the concept of still life?
Yeah, still life, it's a really old and important and relevant aspect of painting. It allows an artist to work from life as they would do going outside and painting landscapes, but from the comfort of their home, in private, in some cases. You can do it anytime, and it's a really excellent experience to spend time looking at something, examining something, and then learning to get into arranging things and understanding the expressive qualities that objects have and how to bring them together into compelling imagery. It's all very exciting.
Yeah, it sounds very interesting, Tim. What day of the week will this class be?
It's on Thursdays at 6:30 p.m.
Thursdays, 6:30, and when is the first one?
It's this Thursday.
Okay. Yeah. And it goes for 4 weeks, is
yes.
that right?
Yes.
And there's probably a lot more information at canvasarts.org,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yes.
Sounds good. Anything else that you'd like to add, Tim?
No, that's it.
I think we covered it all?
Oh, yeah.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for coming in the studio today.
Yeah, thank you.
And have a fun time in the class.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday. It's the 17th of March, 2015. St. Patrick's Day, feast day, celebrating patron saint of Ireland, St. Patrick. Born in Wales, he was 16 when a group of Irish pirates came to the village and took some of the young men, including him, back to Ireland as slaves. He worked for 6 years as a herdsman, then escaped, went back to Wales. But he heard a voice telling him to go back to Ireland and convert the Irish to Christianity, which is what he did after spending 12 years in France. He went to Ireland, founded monasteries, schools, and churches. And so New York City and other cities put on St. Patrick's Day parades. New York's is the largest, 150,000 marchers going up Fifth Avenue, led by the 69th Infantry Regiment. New York has been parading on St. Patrick's Day since 1762, Boston since 1737, and Dublin since 1995. It was on this date in 1959 that the Dalai Lama, Tenzin Gyatso, the 14th Dalai Lama, fled Tibet for India. China had invaded Tibet in 1951 and brought the country under China's rule. There was a resistance movement in Tibet, and when Tibetans believed the Chinese were plotting to kidnap the Dalai Lama, hundreds of thousands of them surrounded his summer palace in Lhasa to protect him. And soon after, in 1959, the Dalai Lama departed on foot with an entourage of 20 men. Soon after that, the Chinese tore down his summer palace. They executed his bodyguards, looted and burned many religious texts, and installed a new spiritual leader, the Panchen Lama, who was pro-Chinese and the rival of the Dalai Lama. The Dalai Lama settled in India, in Dharamsala, along with 80,000 Tibetans in exile. It's the birthday of the playwright Paul Green, born near Lillington, North Carolina, 1894, wrote a successful Broadway play in Abraham's Bosom, and did a stint in Hollywood, wrote many screenplays, and wrote a line that Betty Davis considered her favorite line, "I'd like to kiss you, but I just washed my hair." And it was on this day in 1901 Vincent van Gogh's paintings were shown at the Bernheim Jeune Gallery in Paris, the first major show for the artist who had committed suicide 11 years before. 71 paintings, all with Van Gogh's characteristic bright colors and textured brush strokes, made a big splash on the Parisian art scene. Here's a poem for today from the 17th century, John Wilmot, Earl of Rochester, a poem entitled Love and Life. All my past life is mine no more. The flying hours are gone like transitory dreams given o'er, whose images are kept in store by memory alone. Whatever is to come is not. How can it then be mine? The present moment's all my lot, and that, as fast as it is got, Phyllis, is wholly thine. Then talk not of inconstancy, false hearts, and broken vows. If I, by miracle, can be this livelong minute true to thee, 'tis all that heaven allows. Love and Life from John Wilmot, Earl of Rochester. That's the Writer's Almanac, supported by Progressive Insurance, with its Apron Project, celebrating progress and the people who make it happen. And by Lumosity.com, personalized brain training developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory and problem solving through online games. Lumosity.com. Produced by Joy Biles, assisted by Teresa Burgess. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
This is Bird Note. Sudden bright flash of copper feathers signals a northern flicker's swoop into the backyard. There it hangs by its feet from the suet feeder, a handsome bird a foot long. It's a woodpecker by affinity, but one that hardly looks the part. Where most woodpeckers are a reliable mix of black, white, and bits of red, the northern flicker is buffy tan overall. Its breast sports a distinctive black patch. The undersides of its wings and tail feathers flash with coppery red, giving the bird its western nickname, red-shafted flicker. You're likely to see a yellow-shafted on the Great Plains and in the east. Novelist Jonathan Franzen's first encounter with a flicker highlights its wonderful, anomalous appearance. He writes, "I saw my first northern flicker and enjoyed its apparent confusion about what kind of bird it was. Unwoodpeckerish in plumage, like a mourning dove in war paint. It flew dippingly, in typical woodpecker fashion, white rump flashing, from one ill-fitting identity to another. It's our good fortune that the delightful northern flicker is a common sight, whether red-shafted, yellow-shafted, or hybrid, from backyards to woods to canyons." For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
KTOO's spring membership drive is coming soon. That also means that it's time for the used record, CD, and video sale. If you've got used media you'd like to pass on, bring it down to KTOO the week of March 16th for our semi-annual sale, scheduled for Saturday, March 21st at 9 a.m. For more information, please call Jeff Brown at 463-6425 or email jeff@ktoo.org. Thank you.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Tuesday, March 17th, 2015. I'm your host, Scott Burton. We've got a little bit of extra time on the show today. I always like to play in mudrooms when I get a chance. So here is a story by Pat McClear from 2012.
Next up, we have Pat McClear. Pat is a New Englander. She has been a librarian for the school district for the past 20 years. And she wrote in parentheses, yikes. When asked for a bio to introduce herself, Pat gave us a couple of quotes. She writes, parent of elementary school student. My son was talking about you last night at the supper table. He said that Miss McClear was okay, but she doesn't take no crap from nobody. Pat thinks this might be a good quote for her headstone. Parent of a JDHS student. My son heard you say F asterisk, asterisk, asterisk in the library. This, Pat wrote, is when she began to wonder if there was an opening at the public library. Then the JDHS parent continued, I'm so glad that someone human works here. Wrote Pat, quote, great sigh of relief. Maybe there is a God. A quote from Pat to a friend who was a parent of a kindergarten. Your son said F you, asterisk, asterisk, in the library today. So that was what Pat said to the parent. And then the parent said to Pat, oh, did he learn that from you? Okay, this is Pat's niece, who was a student at the school where Pat was a librarian, once gave her a, quote, cuss jar with a gift tag addressed to the, quote, cussing librarian. Pat says she will try to not cuss in her story. She also wrote that she collects nun dolls. Pat McClear.
The crowd, buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jack. I don't care if I ever get back. So it is the end of November, I'm sorry, the end of October. World Series is over, and it's time to take off the canvas cap and go with the wool. Because the monsoon season has descended on Southeast Alaska. And the days are getting increasingly more dark. October rolls into November. November rolls into December. The rain goes to snane, goes to snow, and the taku winds begin to blow. And then it's time to go with flaps down. And aren't I glad there's no mirror by the door that I go in and out of every day. December's not bad. You got the winter holidays, food, family fun, eggnog. But it's January when the walls start to close in on you, and you're trying to think how you're going to use up your time. Well, certainly you could play cards. You could sew. You might do a little reading, or you watch movies. Okay. Angels in the Outfield, but only the original. The Rookie, Field of Dreams, Bull Durham, if only to watch Susan Sarandon. And then it's February, and you get to put in Fever Pitch, Boston Red Sox, 2004 World Series champions. Then it's truck day.
What?
Truck day? You know when that big-ass 18-wheeler goes down Yawkey Way, parks outside of Fenway, they load it up with the gear, then head down I-95 south to Florida. 2 weeks later, pitchers and catchers report. And now you can go back to the wool because it's spring training. And all that wheeling and dealing that happened over the hot stove in December, well, there it is. You got the rookies, you got the veterans, you got a new manager. And now I can pick up the canvas cap again because it's opening day and the umpire yells, play ball! I come by this naturally. I come by this genetically. 100 years ago, Fenway Park opened. 100 years ago, my father, Charlie McClear, was born. I have some great pictures. He was a tall, lanky, bony-ass kid who knew how to throw a baseball. Pawtucket Times, 1926. McClear had control with either hand and could hit a bird on the back of the ear with a pebble. Charlie told the story that he was playing one day, and he saw my mother sitting in the stands, and he knew that she was the girl he was going to marry. And his prophecy came true. They were married for damn near 60 years, had 6 kids, 18 years between the firstborn and the baby. And they shared a passion, not only for baseball, but for sports. My parents were athletically multilingual. My father played baseball, basketball, hockey, football, and my mother was knowledgeable and opinionated in all of the above and more. Story goes that one day they were going up the ramp in Fenway and Babe Ruth was coming down. Did you talk to him? Did you shake his hand? Did you get his autograph? You tip your cap, you give the man his space. 6 kids, grandchildren, the only picture in my father's wallet, Babe Ruth. Truth. Summer's in New England. It is hot, it is hazy, it is humid. And the only thing that man wanted to do when he came home at night was sit underneath that broad leaf maple with a tall neck bottle of Narragansett beer, listening to Ned Martin call that game live from Fenway Park. Who's up to bat? Who's on deck? The play just went 6-4-3. Yastrzemski makes a great catch out in left field. And in the evenings, the windows are wide open. And you can hear Ned Martin's voice coming over the radio from every room in the house. There's no air conditioning. His voice is your lullaby as you fall asleep, and in your mind's eye, you can see the green monster and that red Citgo sign, and you can imagine that ball sailing right between the two. And in the mornings, you wake up and you say, "Did we win?" When my father was in his 80s, he was sitting underneath that same maple tree, and he was in a funk. And who's to blame him? He had buried my mother the winter before. And 7 years before that, he and my mother buried my sister Paula of, wait for it, Lou Gehrig's disease. Truth. Charlie wasn't into conversation. So I went into the house and I got this book. And I came back out, I sat beside him, and I opened it up and I started talking to myself. I didn't know Dizzy Dean had a brother. Brother? Yeah, he had 2. His brother Paul played with him in St. Louis. They both pitched in the World Series. Okay, I got an answer. So I kept asking questions, and he would elaborate, and he told me stories. He told me stories of the old-timers, the famous and the not-so-famous, the boys he played ball with. My father was a good ball player, but Charlie was an even better storyteller. And that's what gets you through those long, dark, wet, cold winters when it's necessary to go with the flaps down. It's the stories. It's the memories. It's the anticipation of opening day. Go Sox! For it's 1, 2, 3 strikes. You're out at the old ball game.
And that was a Mudroom story by Pat McClear from March 12, 2012. You can hear more stories like that at mudrooms.org. And you're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Tuesday, March 17th, 2015. Scott Burton, your host. It's about 30 minutes until the top of the hour, and I have been joined in the studio now by Sasha Soboloff. We're going to be talking about the gold medal basketball tournament in full swing over at JDHS. Welcome, sir.
Well, welcome. It's great to be here.
Yeah, it's nice to have you. So it kicked off on Monday, is that right?
It kicked off on Sunday. It usually runs Sunday through Saturday. This is Tuesday.
Yes.
We started off Sunday afternoon with some C-bracket games and a couple of B-bracket games. And Monday yesterday was some Masters games and some more B-bracket games. And then today was the first start of the women's bracket that played the first game, and they'll play the last game today. And usually in the B and C and Masters bracket, there are what's called the elimination games. Because this is a double elimination tournament, you can win one and lose one and work your way through the loser's bracket. So today is the D-Day. You either play and win or you go home.
It's an incredibly popular, well-attended tournament. How would you speak to its popularity?
Its popularity really stems back from a fellow who was a Lions Club member back in the early 40s named Lou Love. And my dad, Dr. Soboloff, was in the Lions Club at the time, and they used to meet up in the Gold Room at the Baranoff, and there was 100 members present then. And they said, well, we ought to have a tournament. Maybe that will do what we need to. Because at the time, they were raising funds for the Juno Lions Club by holding, and I remember, pancake feeds at the old Juno Douglas High School that was just recently, or in my freshman year in 1959, they opened it. So we were holding pancake feeds, and my dad would bring me down there, and I'd get to turn pancakes. And so they said, well, we could start a tournament. And so in 1946, they said, well, you know, let's send an invitation out to the small communities in Southeastern to see if they would be interested in. And it was really a twofold thing. One was not only the anticipation of a great basketball event, but at the time it really answered a very strong quest, that was to combat alcoholism, smoking, and drug abuse that was running pretty rampant then. It runs rampant now, but it was more especially then because there was no cell phones, no TV, and you were pretty much on your own, and so you had to train. And so they started off with, they usually had one bracket, maybe 10 teams that would come and play for all the marbles. And that kind of started the tournament, and it was held up at the Capitol School Gym. It's the legislative, Terry Miller Legislative Building now. And at the time, my older sister and I, we were 7, 8 years old, and we'd go up there and play under the bleachers, and Dad would be running the tournament with the other big shots, and we came crawling out one day, and there standing in front of us was Floyd Dryden. And I was like, I looked at my sister, and she said, does he have to be here too? So in its early days, it was one of those opportunities for communities to come by Seine boat, to come by, some came by a seaplane, but most came by Seine boats. They would load up their players and depending upon the weather, would get here in time to hold the tournament. Sometimes the tournament was delayed a day because there would be north winds blowing, because it was always held in then during the month of February. But that started this whole thing, and now 69 years later, we're still plugging away, and we have 24 teams, eight teams in the B bracket and the C bracket, and 4 teams in the Masters and the Women's bracket that play. A double elimination tournament starts on Sunday and ends with championship games on Saturday afternoon.
These games are fun, and it's an exciting place to be. If one of our listeners out there has never been before and they were going to go to one game, they should go to more, I would say, but if they were going to go to one game this week, when would you say they should go?
If they want to really get a true flavor of the game, I would choose a game on either Thursday or Friday, because those are the winner brackets game, we ferreted out all the teams that are kind of going, oh, have another year to prove ourselves. And you're looking at the potential championship games that happen on Saturday beginning at 3 o'clock. And usually on Saturday, with the game starting at 1, if you're not there at the gym by 10, you pretty much won't get into the gymnasium because it's packed. And, of course, it goes to say that all the funds that the Lions Club raises, we turn around and give it all back. We have scholarships that we give to students at $1,000 a year for 2 years. We give to various nonprofits that are throughout the region. We've contributed to Tsunamis. We've contributed to the Huna Food Bank. There are a number of wonderful opportunities that present that goes with the Lions, which has a banner that they have called We Serve, and really that's what this tournament is about. And it takes 3 co-chairs 1 year to plan. And there are probably a working committee of about 15 other people who have spent every week meeting. The next meeting we will have will be in 2 weeks for a critique, and then we'll start the planning process all over again. So it takes a year to get these things all lined up. And so if you're going to go to a game Thursday evening, Friday evening, you'll be right there seeing kind of the cream of the crop.
Sounds a lot of fun. If somebody wants more information, Sasha, where should they go?
We have a website that the Juno Lions Club called, and it's called the Juno Lions Club GoldMedal.org. And I think that's what it is.
I think so. And if you Google gold medal basketball in Juno, I found it right away.
Yeah, if you Google it, it'll take you right there. And there, it gives all the standing for the current teams with the scores, and also along with a lot of pictures. We have an army of photographers and a website person that we've hired that's right there at the gym and posts them right immediately up on the website. So there's ample opportunity to see the action secondhand, if you will.
Sure. And something you said very interesting is that it began as a way to make healthy choices,
yes,
alternatives to alcohol and drug use. Is that still working, and has it inspired new things?
Absolutely. 2 years before my dad passed, there was a fellow who was in the Lemon Creek Correctional Center, and he was from Metlakatla. His name's Jay Booth. And Dad was corresponding with him and saying, when you get out, you need to go into the gold medal. And at the time when he completed his time at Lemon Creek, my dad had passed 2 months before that, and Jay had carved a very decorative paddle and gave that to the Gold Medal Lions Club so we could present it. And Jay actually played in the first tournament, and he said, along the way, Jay was saying, I made a lot of stupid decisions, but one of the best ones I ever made was having some communication with your dad, Dr. Walter Sobolev, that said, keep yourself healthy, keep yourself back, and become a productive member of your community. And by the way, there are some teams that come from Metlakatla, and you need to play for them.
It's a great situation all around to see this. Head down to Juno Douglas High School. Go to the website first to see times there in the afternoon, right, and then a dinner break, and then
yes,
evening.
Yes, so we have an afternoon session and an evening session, and the evening session generally kicks off at 6. Maybe I could give you a thumbnail sketch about the remaining activities. I'll be brief. I know time is precious. This is Wednesday.
Correct.
Tuesday. This is Tuesday.
Yeah.
Tomorrow will be a memorial where we have all the family members who are going to write down the names of those who have lost their friends and their beloved ones from last year, and we have a memorial, very brief candlelight session that highlights tomorrow. On Thursday, we have an opportunity to have some dance groups from the local community come and perform. On Friday, we have some more dance groups that come and perform for the thing. And then on Saturday, there's a preliminary round and a round of a three-point contest. And that's always exciting because anybody can shoot the ball, I think. But also, if you come Saturday, they'll give you a ticket, and you have a chance to win a $35,000 Stanley Ford car with a half-court shot.
Wow. Very exciting. Sasha Sobolev, thank you so much for coming into the studio today. It was a pleasure talking with you.
Pleasure, and appreciate your assistance in the communication. And go all you teams.
man, who's that cat coming down the street?
I don't know, but it sounds to me like that's Wicked Man with the Bone.
Sure having himself a ball.
This is Jim Strader. On behalf of Bartlett Regional Hospital, I'd like to invite you to attend the Juneau Community Health Fair on March 28th. It's a great way for you to get important health information from local health and safety providers and to take advantage of free basic screenings. You can also get high-quality, low-cost blood tests. The health fair is a good place to develop healthy goals and make proactive changes in your daily life. Saturday, March 28th, 9 till noon at Nugget Mall. The Juneau Community Health Fair, sponsored by Bartlett Regional Hospital.
Broadcast of this program is made possible in part by the Alaska Budget Report, specializing in the straight scoop on state government since 1991, on the web at alaskabudgetreport.com.
You're listening to a Juneau Afternoon on March 17th, 2015, and I have been joined in the studio by a very cool crew of young people from the charter school. Welcome, Sage Zond. Did I get that right?
Yeah.
Eva Gehring, welcome, and Meadow Stanley, welcome, and also Jenny and Ryan are here in the back for support. So we're going to be talking about your open house and a couple other things. Why don't we start by telling us a little bit, Meadow has her hand raised, I love it, nice work. Tell us a little bit about what the school's like.
Oh, I was just going to say that open house is next week.
Okay, do you remember what day it is, Meadow?
Next Tuesday? 24th.
Okay, and what time does it start?
I don't know that.
Go for it, Ryan.
It's from, for the kindergarten, it's from 2 to 4 p.m. on Tuesday the 24th. And for the middle school, it's from 4 to 6 p.m. on the 24th. And then also on the 26th, we call it Parent Visitation Day, where parents who are curious to learn more about the school can just come by and see it in action. And that's on the 26th from 9 to 11 or 1 to 3.
Okay, and Sage, what is it like in action? Tell us a little bit about your favorite class or what you like to do at school, that kind of stuff.
Well, my favorite class is probably, we have exploratories there, which are just like an hour of just like fun things with certain like specialist teachers. And my favorite exploratory in class is rock band. And it's just where we get to play instruments like the drums and guitar, and then we get to perform it, and it's just really interesting getting to bond over music.
Oh, good answer. How about you, Eva?
I really like the math. We use CMP3 instead of what the regular other middle schools use. And we also have 2 years of algebra, so that's really nice to really understand it for 2 years. And our math classes are really small. Like, my math class has 6 people in it, and so it's really nice. You can really understand it. And the teachers more ask you for, like, explanatory answers. Yeah, so it's really nice to have that.
Well, it sounds like a nice combination of the arts and math. I like it. And Meadow, what do you like about the school?
Well, I'm only in the 3rd grade, so I'm not in middle school yet.
Okay.
And so I guess my favorite part of school is all the projects.
Okay. And what's one project in particular that you like doing?
Well, maybe it was a couple months ago. We did the May Museum. It was like we just did our timeline and got a giant piece of paper. And we just, like, said when we were born. And, like, we had to do an event, like, when I was 2, I went to Paris or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Wow. That sounds very a nice way to learn. Visual, writing, all these different ways of learning there. Well, it sounds very interesting. I wish we had a ton of time to talk about a lot more stuff at the charter school. Parents, how about a couple more details of what we should be looking out for? Again, maybe the details of the open house and a little talk about the application, maybe?
Sure. So, yeah, the 24th, that's next Tuesday, 2 o'clock for prospective kindergarten parents and 4 o'clock for middle schoolers. And then you can get the application materials on the district's website. So charter school here in town is one of the neighborhood public schools, just like all the rest. So it's free, and there is an application process, but I don't think it's too difficult.
Yeah, and Ryan, if you had to give us a quick couple of sound bites on how the charter school compares to, say, just general public schools here in town, how would you say that?
Sure. So charter schools in the state are run by, or there's what's called an academic policy committee that is parents, basically, who are elected in, and they are, by the bylaws, in charge of managing the affairs of the school. So that committee kind of oversees things. So one of the differences is there's lots of parent involvement. That's why I'm here. That's why I chose the charter school, because I wanted to be able to, for our daughter to go to a school where we'd have a lot of opportunity to be involved. So the school tries to get parents involved in more ways than just as recess aides, but that too. So that's one of the differences. And one of the other big differences is the sort of approach towards individualized assessment. So rather than grades and focusing on sort of those kind of broader measurements, we use portfolios. So every student has a portfolio, and they come to their parent-teacher conferences. And when you look at a student's portfolio, you can see their progress over time. In a really rich, rich way, which is pretty neat.
Okay, and if somebody wants more information, where should they go?
You can go to the district website or directly to the charter school website, which is jccs.junoschools.org, or you can just Google JCCS Juno, I think, is usually how I get to it.
All right, again, I wish we had more time, but I want to thank you all, Sage, Eva, Meadow, Ryan and Jenny, thanks for coming in today, and have fun at your open house.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you. Thank you.
Support comes from the Alaskan Brewing Company. Now hiring for seasonal retail associates in Juneau. More application information at alaskanbeer.com.
And speaking of Alaskan beer, here on a Juneau afternoon today, yes. Mr. Andy Klein from the Alaskan Brewery.
How's it going, Scott?
I am well, sir. How are you?
I'm great. Fun to listen to this show. I love listening to you hosting this show.
Well,
really
thanks.
Fun.
It's nice to see you.
And you're running the people through here, man.
Yeah.
You got gold medal, you got kids, you got everything. You
know, fun day.
Fun day, man. Fun day. Let's cap it off with some fun here.
Let's have a little liquid fun.
Okay. Yeah, we got a brand new beer, and it is part of our pilot series. Pilot series beers are really fun beers for us because we get to kind of experiment, do kind of unusual beers and unusual ingredients, things that people maybe are getting introduced to. Sometimes we'll do like our raspberry wheat as part of our pilot series. But the one that's coming out right now and just appearing in stores right now is our Imperial Rye IPA. So this is a Imperial IPA, so a pretty big, bold beer with some good hop flavor and a little bit of bitterness to it. But then in the boil, we add in rye, just rye grain as well. And that, you know, when you taste rye bread, and you'll taste it in the beer, and you'll get to taste it in the beer in just a moment,
mm-hmm.
sir,
mm-hmm.
as I unopen this beer here. It's got kind of a peppery little bit of an aftertaste and a really clean, fun aftertaste, just a different kind of flavor to a beer that just is a little bit of a, whoa, what's that? That's interesting.
Yeah, interesting. It seems like a lot of breweries, you guys included, are really experimenting with the IPA form.
So, yeah, the IPA segment in craft brewing is the monster segment. It is the one that outsells every other segment almost combined. It's just crazy, and it's growing all the time, too. So just from a business perspective of, like, give the people what they want, the people who are drinking craft beer right now want IPAs. They want IPAs. So it's true. There are a lot of breweries out there really experimenting with IPAs. And on the West Coast, this kind of subgenre of IPAs is called a West Coast IPA. They're really bold, very hoppy, fairly bitter. And as a West Coast brewery, we're getting into that West Coast IPA thing, really trying to keep up with that hoppy, fairly bitter, big, bold taste that people are really loving in IPAs.
And on a scale of 1 to 10, where would you put the hoppiness of this one?
The hoppiness, I would say, is maybe in the 8.5 to 9. I mean, it's like a very, you really smell a fragrant, kind of tropical, hoppy aroma to it, and you'll
Andy,
really taste
it. I can't understand it.
We better just... You want to turn up the mic a little, because
okay,
this is about to... Here we go, ready? Oh, I bumped the mic then.
A little beer atmosphere came out.
A little bit of a...
And Mr. Jeff Brown just joined us in the studio.
Jeff always mentions to come by at these moments. Hello, sir.
Always welcome. Always welcome our producer.
Yes,
the
he
show.
Comes in. This is
Works
part of producing.
Hard.
You know, you want to know if you want to invite back the guests. They have to bring good beer. He's not here to promote bad beer. I'll tell you that.
Mm-mm.
So this is it. It's the Imperial Rye IPA. And I'd say, yeah, first the aroma. It's got a really, number one, you know, like a lot of our beers, even though it's a big Imperial IPA that has a lot of hops featured, we don't leave the malt behind. So you smell the malt and even some of that sweetness that comes through a little bit, which I really like a lot in this. And then, oh, yes. Delicious. Refreshing.
From my label.
Bold, big.
Yeah. From my layperson's point of view, though, too, something about that rye evens out the high end of the hoppiness.
I think you're right. There's a little bit of sweetness that I think is doing that as well. But there is that rye taste. And now, right now, like I haven't had a sip for about 10 seconds or so, I'm getting a pepperiness in the back of my tongue.
Yeah.
And I think that comes from the rye as well. That sort of, you know, rye is a really bold flavor of a grain. You know, so you have to kind of... use it in a sparing way.
Yeah.
But, we added rye. Another fun kind of backstory to this beer is this came out of our one-barrel brewing system. Every one of our employees is actually mandated to team up with a brewer and do a one-barrel brew, so an experimental brew that they're just interested in. And we have a fairly new guy on board who was hired maybe 2 years ago. His name's Aaron Arvidsson, and he's our engineer. He's been the guy who's been doing the project management of our new expansion. And he got really excited about doing the One Barrel Brews and developed this beer. This is really his baby, this Imperial Rye IPA. And it went from a one barrel. It was really extremely popular in the break room, which is where our One Barrel Brews go, and we all kind of have cards and we write on them. It got scaled up to a 10-barrel system, to a rough draft last year, and now here it is as an Imperial Rye. So kudos to Aaron, one of our engineers, not even a brewer, but teamed up with one of our really skilled brewers there, and they developed this recipe and came up with this Imperial Rye.
Yeah, very cool that employees have opportunities like that. I happened to go into the studio, into the brewery the other day with you when you guys kindly donated some beer to our KRNN Spotlight Series. Thank you again.
Yeah.
Total success, way off Broadway.
Yeah.
So fun. Thank you again for support of that. But just walking through that new space, it's just a happening spot.
It is. I mean, you know, craft brewing in general is just an exploding industry, and we're really excited to be one of those companies that's really riding that wave of people really getting into the taste of beer, into this experimental phase where people are not afraid to try new different types of beers. They want all different kinds of beers being produced by their favorite craft breweries, and we're just excited to be a part of that and having a lot of fun doing it. I mean, obviously, it's fun. We're brewing beer, brewing good beer.
Absolutely.
No downside to that.
How's that? What's a good way for people to follow you guys? I know you're on Twitter and Facebook.
Follow that, yeah. Yep. Exactly. I mean, we're alaskanbeer.com. We'll give you the jump-off point for all that stuff. That's where you can find, if you want to find out a bit more about this beer specifically, we got a page dedicated to this beer. You can find it under our pilot series. And yeah, just as you said, follow us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, Instagram, all that stuff. We're real active in social media, and we're having lots of fun on all those platforms all the time.
Well, Andy Klein, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you.
Great
for coming
you.
In.
Thanks,
Have you
Jeff.
Been on KXLL yet today?
Can we go
totally.
Jump over there?
Let's
Sounds
go.
Fun to me.
Yeah.
All right, let's do it.
Cross promotion there.
Yes, we go. Cross drinking promotion.
As we finish this beer. But thank you all for listening to a Juno Afternoon today. Tune in same time, same place. Tomorrow, and Jamie Waste will be your host. We're going to join All Things Considered in Progress.
And I'm Don Gagne. Coming up, the Republican spending blueprint unveiled today.
Jonathan Capehart talks about the hardest column he's ever had to write.
He says he was wrong to buy into the hands-up, don't-shoot narrative about the Michael Brown killing in Ferguson.
Why would anybody trust anything I would have to say if I continued to ignore something so pivotal going forward?
And we'll hear from Ukraine's finance minister about the economic future of her country.
This war is only on some 7% of our territory. 93% of the country is safe, open for business.
Now